And welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here with you every Monday through Friday from noon to 2 on WYPM, WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, streaming live online via the internet at WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. The Disney animation film Frozen recently surpassed the $1 billion mark at the worldwide box office. It now ranks as one of the top five highest-grossing movies of all time. It's already the highest-grossing animated film of all time. But if you can wrap your head around this, Frozen is just one of more than a dozen films my guest this hour, Ed Catmull, has been a part of during his long career in computer animation. When he was a kid, Ed Catmull knew he wanted to be a Disney animator, but when he realized, as he got older, that he didn't have the artistic talent to join Disney's ranks, he turned to physics and later to computer science. And in 1986, along with Steve Jobs and John Lasseter, Ed Catmull co-founded Pixar Animation Studios. He's Pixar's president. He's also president of Disney Animation, which merged with Pixar in 2006. The list of Pixar hits is long and so impressive. Toy Story and the Toy Story trilogy, of course, Monsters Incorporated, A Bug's Life, Ratatouille, Up, WALL-E, Finding Nemo, The Incredibles. Together, his movies have won more than 30 Academy Awards and have raked in billions of dollars in box office sales. But Pixar's story isn't all about success. In fact, the company has gone through many ups and downs over the years and has even faced obsolescence. In his new book, Creativity Incorporated, co-written with journalist Amy Wallace, Ed Catmull recounts the company's history, and by doing so offers incredible insights into what works and what doesn't work as a manager. The book is a bestseller now. It's been in demand all over the place as people in all walks of life, all kinds of businesses have sought it out based on its excellent reviews. It gives a straightforward accounting of what it took to build and foster a creative workplace culture at Pixar. So, Ed Catmull, I want to welcome you to Baltimore, WYPR, here in the Midday Show. We're very pleased to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Dan. I'm really happy to be with you.
You know, there's so many places we could begin our story here. I want to start at the huge success of Toy Story and ask you a couple of questions about Toy Story, because that seemed to be a turning point for you in yourself personally and for Pixar. First of all, you say that Toy Story, which, of course, was a huge success, but you said it represented the fulfillment of a goal I had pursued for more than two decades and had dreamed about since I was a boy. So it's 1995. Why did Toy Story mean so much to you?
Well, when I was in college is when I realized that the art and the technology could come together. And at that time, I came up with the goal of making a feature animated film. In fact, at that time, I thought it would take 10 years to get there, and in fact, it took 20 years. And in that 20 years, it was an incredible time for me working with George Lucas and with Steve Jobs and with John Lasseter and some rather amazing people, but also having friendships with a lot of companies in Silicon Valley, and as they were growing and doing amazing things and then failing. So the centerpiece for me, though, was really was a framework, was getting this film done. And when the film was done, not only did the rest of this industry know we've been pursuing this, we got lots of calls about it, but we got people saying, thank you for starting it, because it opened the doors for other companies to then do computer animation, because they wanted similar sort of things, but they couldn't get the support.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing this, it basically not only got us going, but it launched several companies because we had proven that it was possible.
Well, what I find interesting, but in addition to that, is this idea that, you know, there needs to be an encore. What do you do now? You've had this big success. You weren't sure it was going to happen, but you had this huge success with Toy Story. And then there's this question about what now? And I wanted to quote from your book here and just hear from you a little bit more on this. You say, I had served as Pixar's president for most of the company's existence. I loved the place and everything that it stood for. Still, I couldn't deny that achieving the goal that had defined my professional life had left me without one. Is this all there is? I wondered. Is it time for a new challenge? You know, some people would say, well, wait a minute, just keep doing what you do so well. Keep moving forward.
Well, the way I felt at the time, and I still feel this to this day, is that you do have goals, but when you achieve them, if in doing so you did something original, and then you actually adopt a mindset that I'm going to repeat what I did before, then in many ways you've actually fundamentally altered yourself in a negative way. And the only way to really live up to the goal, which is one of accomplishment, is to say, well, okay, what is the next accomplishment? And it can't be a repeat mm-hmm. of what we did before. And I think it's actually a mistake that a lot of companies try to make, is that the success turns into something they have to hang on to, or becomes their legacy, or they have to live up to this thing. And in doing so, they become conservative and repetitive. It wasn't a matter of saying, okay, well, I want to do something new. I had to figure out, what is that new thing?
Right. Well, I think this is so important, because this really is the heart of your book. This is why you wrote the book. You say here, eventually I found fulfillment trying to protect Pixar from forces that ruin so many businesses. Quote, I began to see my role as a leader more clearly. I would devote myself to learning how to build not just a successful company, but a sustainable creative culture. As I turned my attention from solving technical problems to engaging with the philosophy of sound management, I was excited once again and sure that our second act could be as exhilarating as our first, a sustainable creative culture.
Well, the thing that was driving me is in this period of time as I was figuring this out was the experiences of watching other companies rise and fall. And Silicon Valley, frankly, is full of incredibly creative people and smart people and dedicated and hard workers. But you kept seeing this pattern over and over again, which is still repeated mm-hmm. to this day, is that companies come up, they're very successful, a mythology is then developed about them, and then they'll do something really stupid, and they'll go off the rails. And for me, I'm wondering at the time, it's like, okay, what's going on? It isn't just, can we be creative? Because the answer is, yeah, you can be creative, and you can get smart people together. But what is this mysterious something or force that's going on inside these companies that's causing delusion and having people head off in the wrong direction? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to understand that, because the fundamental belief that I have then and still have is that there are a lot of things that are going on or wrong that we cannot see or interpret. And there are a variety of reasons for that. But if we draw the conclusion that our success means that we're doing the right thing, or our failure means we're doing the wrong thing, that's a very shallow conclusion. And you can end up in the wrong place. And a lot of companies do end up in the wrong place. Is that our success usually is really complex and is mixed in with things that we did that were wrong. And our failures are mixed in with things that we did right. And trying to tease those apart is a very difficult and challenging task, but it is our task.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this then. After that, after Toy Story's release and its success, you decided that you needed to raise more money. You did raise more money. Now you had shareholders to answer to in that period of time after that. I'm sure that increased pressure on you for production and creativity. Could you talk about that period?
Well, the decision to go public, in fact, was made prior to the movie coming out. And it was interesting because Steve gave us a line of logic, which, and Steve's very compelling with his logic, was that Disney would want to renegotiate our contract after Toy Story, and that in order to end up with a better deal, then what we wanted was a 50-50 partnership, which meant that we had to put up half the money, which meant that we needed to go public. So we bought into the logic, but in fact, that's what happened. So we went public 1 week after Toy Story came out. Now we're a public company. But here was the good thing, and I would say that going public for me, didn't alter the pressure. And the reason was is that Steve, to his core, has a long-term view. And so the kinds of things that going public can cause to some companies didn't happen to us because Steve was there protecting us on that business side to make sure that we kept the focus on what the basis of the company was, which is making good films.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this about management. Once you got past Toy Story and you had decided you needed to take a close look at what it would take to maintain or sustain a creative culture at Pixar, what about this idea of the manager getting out of the way? Once you've assembled your creative team, it all worked the first time, then what do you do as a manager? Some people think the less managed, the better creative people are.
Well, this is, I think, one of the things we had to thread through very carefully. And I think we ended up with a really good balance there. And the balance was that we said that John was the creative leader and still is the creative leader of the company. And Steve was the external force for the company. But Steve never told us how to do anything internally. And it actually surprises people, but the culture here was very different. It was even different than what Steve had at Apple or at Next Computer. And my job was to run the internals. And so together we had this really nice balance between ways of looking at things. But then the next trick, and this is true for John, because John realized this, that in order for the creative people working for us in other places, that we also had to get out of their way. And that while he might be the final call, and especially while his final call as director, that there's something about stepping back and ceding creative authority to other people, which actually brings more out of them.
You know, what we can do is, when we talk about each film project here with you, Ed, Monsters, Toy Story 2, there's a lesson in each one of these that you pull from this. Because the book isn't it's not a memoir. There's some great instruction in here for people in all walks of life, as I said before. So before we go to the break, let me try one example of that. We heard the Toy Story story. What about Monsters Incorporated? You say this is a good example of the importance of creating an environment in which mistakes don't strike terror in the hearts of your employees. Monsters, Inc.
Well, the thing we learned as we're coming out of these other films was that we kept making mistakes. And what I was trying to get at is, okay, what's the underlying way of thinking about mistakes and errors? And the first reaction was, how do we prevent the mistakes? So we put a lot in place to try to prevent mistakes and errors. And then realized that actually that we couldn't prevent the mistakes and the errors. So we had to rethink what it meant to make a mistake or to fail at something. Mm-hmm. And it was in rethinking that the underlying philosophy was put in place that we use to this day. And it's, I mean, for me, it's very important. It's one of the things I try to capture in the book is how do you think about your failures and mistakes? And people conflate several different ideas, and they almost can't help it. So if you just take the notion of a failure, then there is one side of it, which is that we all know academically that that's part of learning. And so that's something we can talk about, and its importance in our lives. But on the other hand, failure has a meaning that we learn in school, which is that you didn't apply yourself, or you were dumb, or you screwed up. Mm-hmm. But failure also has a meaning in the world we see every day in the news, and that is if a company or a government official makes a mistake, then opponents will use it as a bludgeon against them. So there's a real aura of danger around failure and mistakes. Well, the fact is these two meanings, one of them which is part of learning and the other which is dangerous, they exist simultaneously inside of us, and they make it difficult for us to tease them apart. So it's pretty easy to go on the, is I don't want the mistakes or failure to happen and end up making some poor choices as a result.
Hmm. So the concept of having zero failures is worse than useless, you say, when it comes to anything creative, creative endeavors.
Yes. Well, in fact, it's another area where you have a conflation of two different ideas. So there are areas where zero errors make sense, like in the flight industry,
right,
where it makes sense to you and I as passengers, but also to the industry and to the manufacturers. And it's also a simple idea to understand. But there's some areas, like education, for instance, where zero errors isn't a helpful concept. And if we look inside of in our process, zero errors actually is a damaging concept. It doesn't mean that a lot of errors are then good, but what it means is the sweet spot is really hard to see. So people tend to want to go to the simple concept of zero errors and apply it in those cases where it's not really useful.
We're going to take our first break on Midday and then resume our conversation with Pixar co-founder and president Ed Catmull, co-author of Creativity Incorporated, Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration. That's the subtitle. As we head into this break, let's hear from Pixar's Toy Story, which introduces us to these two lovable characters.
Buzz Lightyear to Star Command. Come in, Star Command. Star Command, come in. Do you read me? Why don't they answer?
My ship!
Blast. This'll take weeks to repair. Buzz Lightyear mission log, stardate 4072. My ship has run off course en route to Sector 12. I've crash-landed on a strange planet. The impact must have awoken me from hypersleep. Terrain seems a bit unstable. No readout yet if the air is breathable. And there seems to be no sign of intelligent life anywhere.
Hello?
Hey, good morning, Metropolis. It's now 5 after the hour of 6 a.m. in the big monster city. Temperature is a balmy 65 degrees, which is good news for you reptiles, and it looks like it's going to be a perfect day to maybe, hey, just lie in bed, sleep in, or simply work out that slam that's hanging over the bed! Get up, Sully!
And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. A clip there from Monsters Incorporated, one of the Pixar films. Ed Catmull, president and co-founder of Pixar Animation Studios and president of Disney Animation, is our guest in this hour of Midday. His book, Creativity Incorporated, is co-written with journalist Amy Wallace. It's published by Random House. Ed, again, thanks for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
Yeah, Toy Story 2, a good example that unforeseen things happen, but it's important not to blame people when it happens.
So, for me, while this was our third film, Bugs Life was the second, Toy Story 2 was the defining moment of the studio's history. And there were so many things we learned from that. And it was the film that also had a crash and burn, and we had to do a restart on it. But one of the problems along the way was that while we're making the film, somebody in deleting a few files made the mistake of deleting the files, but they were in the master directory of the film when they did it. And what it did was it deleted the entire movie. And of course, we were in shock. And then we follow that up by immediately saying, okay, we'll go to the backups and get the movie, only to find that the other group responsible for the backups didn't notice that they were failing. So we had genuinely lost the movie. So at this point, we are completely screwed. And fortunately for us, the technical director is a woman who had just had a child, and she wanted to work at home for part of the time, so she had taken the entire copy of the movie to her home on her computer. So this was now the only copy we had. So in realizing that, drove to her house, wrapped the computer in blankets, and drove very carefully back over the bridge to where the company was. So these are like three random events that sort of pile up on each other. And And the truth was that a couple of them were screw-ups. And again, it was like, well, you know, the screw-ups are going to happen. And if you're saying to people that it has to be okay to make mistakes and learn from them, that means when they make a mistake, you can't punish them. So you don't want people there who've got bad intents or people that are lazy. I mean, there are reasons why you may not want people in a group, but making a mistake should not be one of those things. So we never even tried to find out who made the original mistake in deleting it. Everybody knew that it was serious. But there was also another message here is, guys, we're all in this together. We're going to make mistakes. Let's not make it dangerous to make mistakes. Because if you make it dangerous, then you've introduced a level of fear into the organization, which causes people to shut down or be secretive about things. Hmm. And we didn't want to go there.
Was that episode particularly shocking? Because the people you hire, if your company, the people who work on this team are, you know, supposedly or are technically savvy?
Well, yeah, in one sense, yes. But on the other hand, I know in those days, we're still early in computer graphics. We're figuring things out. We're figuring out our processes. And we're trying to disentangle making the process better from allowing for mistakes to happen. So my tendency was to try to err on the side of saying, you know, as long as the intents are right, then we can use it as a learning experience. Now, at that time, we were hoping for the film that we could do the right way. And that film was Finding Nemo, because Finding Nemo had like the perfect pitch and the perfect setup for it. But in fact, we found we had just as many problems with Finding Nemo as we did with any other film. And that's when I realized, oh, okay, there's something about this trying to make it exactly right, which is probably misguided. And throughout our entire history, so we've now done 14 films, we've got some in process. We continue to have screw-ups. It's just they're different. So we've never had a backup problem like that again, all right, because we fixed that. But we keep uncovering more problems and mm-hmm. more mistakes. Mm-hmm. And we've had three films where we've had meltdowns. And you'd say, well, they were failures. It's just that we kept the failures in-house. We don't release them to the public. And then we'll take a failure and say, okay, what do we learn from it? How do we get better so that we don't make that mistake again? Mm-hmm. But we don't make the mistake of saying our goal is to never make mistakes.
You also never take risks, do you? I mean, that's sort of the point, isn't it? If you're so worried about preventing mistakes, you risks are never taken. People are in fear of making a mistake.
That is the point.
Yeah,
is that the risk taking, which intellectually we know we have to do if we're doing something original, carries with it the corollary that the risk might not pay off. So you go down a certain path, you know that it's risky, and the way you know it's risky is you fail once in a while. Mm-hmm. And if you never failed, then the real conclusion is, oh, I was playing it too safe. And so while I'm trying to be safe, I basically sell my soul to safety and don't do something original.
Ed, when you're putting a team together or you have a team assembled to work on a project, the next film and development, it must be hard to manage all these different personalities and to find the right chemistry for a team working together.
Well, there are several important things, I think, when putting a team together, and it's related to risk. So at one extreme, you'd say if everybody was experienced on the team, then the project will probably go smoother. But you're not giving new people the chance to grow. If you put too many new people on a film, then they may not have enough experience to recognize when there's a major problem. Even though they're technically qualified for it, you actually want some experience to know, just to recognize problems. So again, that's a risk factor. So we try to go in the middle where you introduce something new to a team with some experience in it. So that's the point you figure out what your risk in the team is. And then you go to the second stage, and the second stage is to see how well that team works together. And the interesting concept here is that you can't judge them by their product at that point, because our films don't work at the beginning. So if we judge them by their output, we would judge them negatively. So instead, you have to judge them by how well they're working together and their camaraderie and their focus and their laughter, the things you would expect to have. So there's that middle part where they bond together. And then finally, when the film gets in its last stages, you've got a fully bonded team that becomes extremely productive. So the task really is that middle part of making sure the team is working together. And if it's not, recognizing it and making adjustments or coaching or anything to help them become stronger as a group.
Would you say, and maybe the answer is obvious because Pixar has had so much success, would you say that was true for almost every project, every film that you've put out? You felt as you near the end of the project, yeah, this team came together nicely, maybe had some bumps, but now we're together and it's clicking.
Well, when we've had meltdowns of films, the real reason for it was that we put together a team, we took our risks, and the team did not meld as a group. And then normally what happens is behind the scenes, people raise flags. We then start to address it and do the coaching. And that usually works. But we've had a couple of times where, as a result of doing all that, the team never really gelled. And then we have a meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have a meltdown, that means like everybody knows there's a problem. And we'll pull the plug and we'll do a restart on the film. So if I look at our history and I say, we know what we were trying to do. We know what we were working on to fix. And we were not always successful internally. So what showed our values was that even at the very end, if it wasn't working out, we were willing to pull the plug.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Dan Roderick's here. My guest is Ed Catmull, president of Pixar Animation and Disney Animation. We're talking about his book, Creativity Incorporated, written with Amy Wallace, Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration. If you'd like to join us on Midday with a question for Ed Catmull, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. Or send me a question by email, midday@wypr.org. So, Ed, some companies, startups, crash and burn in Silicon Valley. Do you have a better understanding today about why that happens? What would you say are the main reasons why startups, people make decisions that send their companies off the rails?
Well, there are different phases of the startup crash and burn. So sometimes a group comes together and they don't gel. They fail and it falls apart, and they have venture capital funding and the knowledge they learned in that failure then accrues to the individuals, but they split up and they go to different companies, so that original company is gone, but the overall expertise of the valley goes up because these people have learned from their mistakes and their failures. The other kind of failure happens though is when they're successful. And they go public, and they've actually had really great products, and they've made a difference in the world. But then they've drawn the wrong conclusions from the success. Hmm. And what you find is a variety of forces in the way. Sometimes their business model has got powerful forces trying to protect it when the outside world is changing. Like this is frequently true with sales organizations. And if the company doesn't have the will to make the changes, then they will hang on to something while the world crumbles out from underneath them. Now, over time, we still see this. A lot of companies are coming up in the internet. Most of them fail. A few of them become big, and then others come in and copy or steal people away, and you've got this really rapid mix of expertise moving around and failures and success, and a lot of storytelling about what works and what doesn't work. But one of the things I found is that most people want to skip the hard stuff. They want the advice so they can get to the, the right conclusion. And that tendency to try to skip the hard stuff, I think, is one of the things that gets in the way of a lot of companies. is that what we really have to do is to say the hard stuff is the company building. We don't try to go around it. We don't try to skip it. We don't ask for the great aphorism, tell how to go through it. It's like you just go straight into it, knowing that there's going to be some damage along the way.
I really like some of the conclusions that you've come up with in the book from your own experiences, your years at Pixar. So I have several of those I want to go over with you and hear you talk about a little bit more. But we're going to do that after our next break. But I wanted to ask you this. Steve Jobs, John Lasseter, you think of people with big personalities who are involved in companies, and they have teams of people working for them, right? So
yes.
you assume, I don't know, with Steve Jobs, I assume, from everything I've heard about him or read about him, that is such a big creative personality. How do you work with somebody like that when it's his idea, basically, that is dominating, that's pushing the train along the tracks? How do people, of course, I'm talking about Apple now, but he was involved with you with Pixar, too. How do people get up the nerve to be creative and speak frankly and openly and with imagination in front of someone like Steve Jobs or even yourself?
Well, let me talk specifically about Steve, because I think I may have worked longer continuously for him than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a gigantic misconception about Steve, which I like to clarify. And that is that Steve went through what we would call the classical hero's journey. So here's this really smart guy. He's cast out of something which he helped build, the original Apple. He goes off sort of wandering around and learning something, and then he returns to Apple and transforms it. But if you look at the public or the outside view, there's the early Steve who was an extraordinarily strong personality that did run over some people. And I witnessed this in the early days. But what people didn't realize is that Steve was extraordinarily smart, and he was also introspective. And as he was making these mistakes, he was learning from them. He was learning that a lot of time his overreaching didn't work and had some negative consequences. And about 10, 15 years ago, he tied all of this together, and he changed as a person. Now, what happened is after he changed, he became more empathetic, more open, a more careful listener, and more careful about how he delivered the truth as he saw it to people. And after he made that change, basically everybody that was with Steve stayed with him throughout the entire, for the rest of his life. So the problem was that if people wanted to write about Steve, I would get interviewed about him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Steve was still alive. None of us were going to psychoanalyze our boss or talk about the changes.
Right.
So this whole section of Steve's change was missing from the public record. He's not the same person that everybody thinks of. So what they see is that original Steve they knew about. Then they saw the success of Apple and figured, well, he just took that guy, he got a little bit smarter, and then he applied it to Apple, and there was a big success, not recognizing the actual change that took place in him. Now, in the case of Pixar, I had a relationship with Steve, and Steve and I never had an argument in all the years that we worked together. We disagreed, but we worked out a way of working through the disagreement. But we never had an argument.
Hmm.
And Steve never told John what to do. In fact, we have a group called the Brain Trust, which gives the notes on our films, and they're the ones that work out the issues for a film. Steve never went to a Brain Trust meeting because he knew that his personality was so large that it would affect the dynamics of the room. And the dynamics of the room is critical to our success. So Steve had enough wisdom to say, I won't go to that room.
Oh, wow. He did have some insight there. So that's very interesting what you're telling us about the last, especially the last two decades of his life, becoming more sensitive to people's feelings and their value as contributors. And then in this case, knowing enough to stay out of the room because he knows people may not speak freely.
Yeah, and for us as a company, it was really a big deal. So yeah. How do we get people to speak freely? And that room has got a lot of people with strong egos and strong personalities and strong opinions. So our challenge is, and which is a continual challenge, is how do we make it safe for people to say something, to say what they think, and how do we remove the barriers for people to be candid with each other?
Ed Catmull is a co-founder of Pixar Animation Studios, the president of Pixar and president of Disney Animation, our guest in this hour of Midday on WYPR. His book, Creativity Incorporated, Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration. Random House is the publisher. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrigues here, speaking with Ed Catmull. There you go, little Randy Newman from Toy Story. Yeah. Hey, you know what I wanted to say about Toy Story 2 to you, Ed Catmull? I just need to admit this on the radio. There's the scene in Toy Story 2, the song When Somebody Loved Me, I think it's Sarah McLachlan sings it.
Yes, yes.
I can't watch it anymore, Ed. I can't watch that anymore. It gets to me. It gets right to where I live. I become a complete emotional mess during that song. So.
Well, you know, it was...
And you live to hear that, don't you, Ed? You live to hear that, right?
Ah, yes, that's right.
Well, you said that Steve Jobs, when it came to Pixar, he was very proud of Pixar, maybe more proud than he was of Apple, because he felt like... what's the quote here? He said, Apple products, eventually they all ended up in the landfills. Pixar movies, on the other hand, would live forever.
Well, he did say that to us, although I know his real heart and soul was in Apple, and while the products were there, I mean, he did believe to his core that he was doing something that was going to change the world. Hmm. And he has, and Apple has done that. And he liked it because they were two different kinds of things. One was changing the way we worked and interacted with each other, and the other was in the telling of stories, which is how we communicate with each other.
Hey, I want to go over a few things, pull some quotes from your book and just have you elaborate on them a little bit. This actually applies to Steve Jobs. When someone has a strong personality, others can wilt in the face of their intensity. How do you prevent this from happening? I like this part, Ed. The trick is to shift the emphasis in any meeting away from the source of an idea onto the idea itself.
Yeah, it's a hard concept for people to get, but it's the realization that we are not our ideas. And the normal thing is you come in with a little bit of fear and apprehension because you're going to present an idea, so you're putting yourself on the line. That's the way we think of it, because we identify with what we're going to say. Or if somebody else something, we might wilt under what they say. And if you can step away and say, I'm not my idea, I'm also not my problem. And by stepping away from it, we can then focus on it and rather than be the problem or be the idea. For Steve, the trick, and it was hard for people to see this, is to recognize that when he advocated something strongly, he wasn't actually saying it was right, although it sounded like when he was talking it. He was testing it. And this is where he connected really strongly and emotionally with the directors, because he realized that that's what they do. Is you go into a mode where you pitch something, and you need to pitch it like you believe it to test it. Then you go into a different mode, and you want the critics, the people around you, with candor to say, oh, I don't think that works. This doesn't relate to me, or this idea doesn't work. And you listen to that. And if what you hear resonates, then you change your mind. You don't attach yourself to what you said. You separate it from it. But if you just pay attention to the intensity, then basically you'd back off. And the trick was to learn with Steve that he didn't want you to back off. He wanted you to say what you thought and to defend it. And in doing so, that's when he respected you.
Let's following along there, Ed, to this quote. It's not enough merely to be open to ideas from others. Engaging in the collective brain power of the people you work with is an active, ongoing process. As a manager, you must coax ideas out of your staff and constantly push them to contribute.
Well, this is one of those areas also where we have an emotional and an intellectual side. So intellectually, we know that people have different views of things or they see things in a different way. Emotionally, we only see what we see, and so we can easily go into I'm right and they're wrong. And if you go down the one path of I want to be right and somebody opposes it, then you got this thing where the ideas are competitive with each other. And the trick is to go to the other side, which is to say each of these other people actually has a perspective, and what I want to do is I want to add them together, and that combined perspective is a bigger pool. And it's not that everybody's right or everybody's wrong or anything like that. It's just with a bigger pool of ideas, you can broaden the base that you're drawing from to come up with a better, in our case, movie. But I think it's true with any product in general. So our trick is to get everybody moving over to the status of thinking of, I want to hear the other side. I want to know what the opposite ideas are, because there's some truth there that they're seeing that I'm not seeing. How do I open myself up to that?
I like this too. When looking to hire people, give their potential to grow more weight than their current skill level. What they will be capable of tomorrow is more important than what they can do today. That's an easier said than done, Ed. Folks who go into hiring, they sometimes worry about what the potential is. They don't see it, and they want the guaranteed skilled person ready to go right from day one.
Well, it was on Bug's Life, our second film, where we fell into that trap, where the people responsible for making the film had schedules and budgets, and so their criterion was, does the person I'm interviewing meet the bar? And typically, a lot of people that are out looking for jobs might meet the bar, but they've kind of peaked where they are. And so what we realized after that we had grown so fast, we let that criterion dominate. And said, okay, that's a bad criterion. Under that criterion, most of us would not have hired ourselves when we were applying for the job. So instead you say, okay, what's this person capable of? And some of the people actually may not hit the level, but statistically, by a considerable margin, you end up way ahead, because the high potential people, in fact, come up to speed very quickly. And then they go way beyond what you had originally hoped for. And if that's your criterion, you end up way ahead.
Here's another one I like. Give a good idea to a mediocre team and they will screw it up. But give a mediocre idea to a great team and they will either fix it or come up with something better.
Well, this is one of the things that came out of Toy Story 2, where we had a really good idea for the film. In fact, the idea of Toy Story 2, the film, if you were to compare it against the final film, you'd say, oh, that's about what I would have expected from that idea. But as I told you, that film had a complete meltdown. And the team that we had assembled, although they were good as individuals, they did not come together as a team, and it utterly failed. So the original team that had made Toy Story came back on Toy Story 2 and then made this film that was even better than the first one. And it was at this time when I'd had lunch with the president of another animation studio. And he told me that his key problem was not finding good people. It was finding good ideas. And it was such a stupid thing to say. I was actually almost knocked off my chair. But that's when I realized, oh no, actually, people get this wrong. A lot of people get it wrong. Is that first of all, it's a false dichotomy. I mean, ideas are not people. So by thinking that you're looking for ideas, you're actually putting your attention in the wrong place. That really what you wanted to say, I just want a really good team of people, and they're going to come up with something. And if I screw that up, then they will not fix any problems, and they'll probably take whatever they've got and go the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And we've used that philosophy to this day. It's like, get that team right. It all rides on that.
Hey, Ed Catmull, I just wanted to take a few minutes here toward the end of our time together to ask you about some favorite moments from these films, starting with the Toy Story back in 1995. So we're coming up on 20 years since then. What are some of your favorite moments? I mentioned one from Toy Story 2 that's a personal favorite of mine, although I know I'm going to be an emotional wreck when I watch that scene from Toy Story 2, that song. What about yours? What are your favorite moments from it? Can you name a couple?
Well, my favorite moments are, I'll name two or three. There's something about the turnaround of Ratatouille, because Ratatouille is probably one of our most unlikely ideas. It was one where we had a meltdown and a redo, but we ended up with something which was beautiful and sophisticated. And I love the fact that we took something which would have failed an elevator test. It's not the sort of thing that anybody would ever invest in or you say you should do. And we made a very a phenomenal film there. And I like the fact that some of our films take that kind of risk. The other one of my favorite things, to be honest, was when Disney acquired us, we made this decision to keep the two studios completely separate, which meant that we wanted to take the principles that we had developed and apply them to a group that had failed. And it took some time and a lot of work, but we turned this group that had failed into an extraordinarily successful group, and it's largely the same people. And the fact that that they went from dispirited to a lively engaged people is something which I love and I thoroughly enjoy. And the third thing I love is, and it's a hard one because it's an abstract one, is that when we have problems at Pixar, and as I've mentioned, we do all the time, and we get together to discuss them, that nobody turns to the leadership, so it's John or Jim Morris, who's the general manager, or me, and say, what are you guys going to do to fix the problem? The way they discuss it is to say, what are we going to do to solve the problem? And that's the tone. And when I walk out of that feeling like they own the problem, then I just feel great.
Yep. I can see why. You created the environment you set out to create.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Ed, continue good luck. More good movies ahead. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, Ed Catmull, president of Pixar Animation and Disney Animation. The book is Creativity, Inc., Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration. Thanks again, Ed.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning into our first hour of midday. Enjoy the rest of this song, Randy Newman from Toy Story, and then we'll see you for the second hour of our show.